Hi, I'm Heather Mulder.
And I'm Janice Greeno, and you're listening to Dementia Untangled, where we explore the topic of dementia through conversations with physicians, experts, and community leaders.
Our discussions focus on innovative ideas, practical strategies, and proven methods to guide caregivers along a supportive path.
Hello and welcome to Dementia Untangled. Thank you for joining us for this episode of our podcast.
Today, our conversation will be with Dr. Robert W. Turner II, an assistant professor at the George Washington University School of Medicine and Health Sciences in the Department of Clinical Research and Leadership. More locally in Arizona, he is a visiting faculty fellow at the Arizona State University Global Sport Institute, and we will be discussing Black men's brain health. What we know is that Black Americans are more likely to develop Alzheimer's disease than other racial or ethnic groups. We also know they are less likely to participate in research. We know across the board, Alzheimer's disease carries a stigma, making it difficult to talk about and face, and in turn, making it difficult to support people and families who are living with dementia. When I think of someone who is going at an issue from all sides, Dr. Turner comes to mind. His Black Men's Brain Health Initiative is a multifaceted approach to raising awareness and participation, starting conversations, and engaging the next generation of researchers.
And last year, it was such an honor to join Dr. Turner and NFL players, collegiate players, coaches, Hall of Famers at the Black Men's Brain Health Conference during Super Bowl week. And Heather, did you know that the NFL's football is the most popular sport in America? And that the Super Bowl not only is such an exciting time of year for fans, last year the Super Bowl was here in Glendale, Arizona, and there were so many festivities. And I don't think most fans were thinking about brain health, but Dr. Turner was, and he is, and he engaged others in helping to shine a light on such valuable research and collaborative partnerships around this important topic. And I believe he is making a huge difference.
Welcome, Dr. Turner. Thank you for joining the conversation.
It's great to be here. Thank you. I'm really excited. I'm glad that I had a chance to meet Janice. And it was so exciting to be out there in Arizona last year. And, you know, we had new friends. We met working with that community, and look forward to some folks. Maybe they'll be traveling this year from Phoenix and all of Arizona and see us again when we are in Vegas and during the Super Bowl week.
I'm looking forward to learning more about this initiative. But before we do, you have a really interesting journey. Could you tell us what led you to connect with the dementia community?
Yeah, well, I mean, what ultimately led me there is a couple of things. But, you know, my dad, as I have mentioned publicly in the past, he's been diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. He's about in a mid stage now. He's doing really well. I'm his primary caregiver. And, you know, he's to the point now where he can't be left alone, but he still can do many of his other activities of daily living. And that's great. But I've seen two of my aunts, unfortunately, suffer from the disease as well. And I've seen how much it robs from individuals. I've seen how much it causes the family, you know, how it turns the family upside down. So this is something that is very near and dear to me. And then, of course, having played football myself for 16 years, I was started off, you know, playing as a little peewee kid all the way down. I think my first year was at 10 or 11 years old, and I was fortunate enough to earn a college scholarship to go to James Madison University in Virginia after playing 4 years of high school football in New Jersey. And then I went on a journey to play in professional football as well. I was initially drafted by the New Jersey Generals in the old USFL. They have a new iteration, but I was in the original iteration and I was drafted by Memphis, which my claim to fame there was that I was in the same draft class as Reggie White, who played, went on to play in the USFL and then in the NFL. And after I finished in New Jersey for the New Jersey Generals, I wound up going up to the Canadian Football League and playing in Calgary for a couple of years. And I preceded Doug Flutie up there. But then I finished my career with a brief stint in San Francisco for the 49ers. And I tell people that my claim to fame there was to back up Ronnie Lott. And then I was on two teams that was wedged between two Super Bowls. So they won the year before. When I got there that year, they did not make it to the Super Bowl, which is probably that why they got rid of me, because they came back and won another Super Bowl after that. But, you know, when I went to graduate school, one of the things they told me to do is to write what you know, study what you know. And I started working on NFL athletes and their transition to life after football, which is the name of my book, is NFL Means Not For Long, the life and the career of NFL athletes. And during that time, it was at the height of when Junior Seau had committed suicide, Dave Duerson, Andre Waters, guys that I knew very well and guys that I knew of that had played in the league before me or during the time that I was there. And I started to think about all of the issues. And I wanted to know, what is this thing about CTE? How does it impact people? Then I come to learn that, you know, it is a neurodegenerative disorder, the same way, very similar to Alzheimer's and other diseases of that nature. And I started to wonder, how does this impact men? And given the fact that the NFL is 70% men of color, primarily Black men, and then you look at even college football, where, you know, there's tens of thousands of people who are playing, many of which are Black men as well. And what do we know about how this disease would affect them, their communities, the risk factors, the vulnerabilities? What are the protective factors? What is the psychosocial dimension? That's what led me here. And I realized very quickly there's just not enough people who are studying in this particular arena. And we have such a big challenge in getting these men to participate in research. So that's kind of what led me to where I am today.
I think you have such a fascinating story, both this family connection and being a family caregiver, but then also being a former football player. You have both this personal and professional connection. And I love that you say, do what you know. And it seems like in your work, you're really pulling together these personal and professional connections to make a difference. Can you give us the highlights? What are some of the ways that you are doing this in your work?
Well, I think the most important way, and again, my work isn't specifically only limited to Black men. That's really kind of when it comes to brain health where I focus, but it's not the only, because I'm doing a study right now where we wanted to understand, it's in partnership with my research lab at Duke University, and it's an athlete brain health study. And so we wanted to understand levels of exposure to concussions and how those different levels of exposure might impact your later life cognition or, you know, your cognitive functioning over time. So what we do in that particular study is it's open to everyone and all men. And we look at men who played non-contact sports, such as, you know, being a swimmer or, you know, rowing or you know, crew, or you're being track running or any of those kinds of things. And they have the lowest rate of exposure to concussions. And then we look at college football players, former college football players, and all that study. There are men who are 28 and older and go all the way up to, I think we have the oldest person is about 85, 90 years old. And then we, of course, that's the medium level of exposure. And then we look at former NFL or professional football players that have the largest number of, you know, exposures. And so I have to tell you, I'm looking out at my backyard, which I've never seen this before, but there's a peacock back there. I didn't know we had peacocks in New Jersey. It's a wild bird. I don't know why it's in my backyard, but it's beautiful to see. But it's unbelievable. It really is. It's really unbelievable. I should take a picture. But so we're really trying to understand, again, and in my work, we understand the psychosocial as well as the neurocognitive issues. Like, for instance, one of the reasons I focus on men, I want to understand how being a man, their attitudes and their beliefs, how does that impact their overall behavior, their health behavior? Does that put them at greater risk, some men, or does it serve as a protective factor? How do they talk to their doctors about this? How do doctors engage with them? So those are things that are really important in terms of understand kind of some of the very unique dimensions. And so what we do is, in my work, we take what's from, we borrow from the National Institute of Aging, Dr. Carl Hill, who is also works now at the Alzheimer's Association. But he has the Health Disparities Research Framework, which really focuses on the cultural kind of aspects or social dimensions of what would how those things uniquely impact a particular population. And so probably the biggest thing that I am really focusing on is trying to understand men's lived experiences. How do they talk about their health? What do they think about brain health? If we can put that and really help inform kind of the larger picture of the health outcomes, then we can understand translationally how to speak to doctors, clinicians, social workers, family members, all those people engage with impacting the health outcome of these individuals.
Dr. Turner, I think we should take a break here and let you go take a picture of that peacock.
All right. Let me see if I can do that. Okay. I don't know if it's still back. All right. I'm back. Can you hear me?
Yes. Were you successful?
I was. I caught a video, the whole bit. I've never seen anything like that before. I live in Central Jersey, not far outside of of New York City. And this thing just walking around the property.
That's
like,
wild.
Like I'm at a zoo. It's unbelievable.
Oh, crazy. Oh, my goodness.
I had to take a picture because no one's going to ever believe that.
Right?
I'm at my dad's house, and he's been living in this house for 52 years. Nothing like that has ever happened.
Wow. Oh, I'm so glad you got a picture and a video.
I do, indeed. So thank you for indulging me and allowing me to do that. No one would ever believe that that would be the case, but right. Here it is.
Okay. Well, let's get back to it and we'll just go on like nothing ever happened.
I'm ready.
Dr. Turner, what a well-rounded and, as Heather said, multifaceted approach to the men's lived experience. And I would like you to tell us a little bit more now about the conference. It is opening doors to conversations. Share with us about that conference and how it came to be and what the goals are.
Sure, sure. So that conference started really kind of as an idea between myself and Ron Rice, who played 8 years for the Detroit Lions and was at one point when he was living up in Detroit. He was the director for their NFL Alumni's Association's local chapter. So he was running the chapter. And I actually one day was giving a talk at Wayne State University about my book. They invited me to come up and talk about my book. And Ron was there, and it was unbeknownst to me, there was about three or four guys that had played in the NFL. And I had never met Ron at that point. And so I go through the whole process and the whole book and everything. And then and when we opened it up to the Q&A, it was amazing. One of the players there had said, former players, he said, I've been to lots of talks. I've heard lots of people talk to the NFL. He goes, but I have never heard of anyone who has captured my life the way your research has done. And you know, some people thought maybe I planted him in there or something like that. But through that, we wound up building this relationship. And Ron Rice and I said, you know, there's so many issues that former athletes have, particularly former football players. We need to do something about this. And so I introduced Ron to another really, really good friend of mine, Dr. Deb Stroman, who was the first African-American Black woman on scholarship at the University of Virginia to play for women's basketball team. And so we said, hey, let's do this thing together. We started it. And we just went down to Mahari, or I'm sorry, we went down to Morehouse in Atlanta, and through working with some folks, they allowed us to just put something together and talk about the book and talk about brain health, mental health issues, those kinds of things. The response was overwhelming. We just opened up the microphone and we allowed men who had played in the NFL or played in the USFL, played professionally, to talk about their stories. And it was so powerful. We said, well, we need to turn this into something. So we approached Beasley Reese, who at the time was the president, CEO of the NFL Alumni Association. And he really kind of set the course. He said, I want to do something. He goes, but Doc, you know, all we tend to hear from professional football players about our health and about our brain health is that it's always something negative. It's always bad news. He goes, is there any good news? And so instead of just narrowing it down to mental health, we said, let's do a brain health conference where we can talk about the protective factors as well as the risk factors. What are men doing that's helping to protect their brain, preserve their brain? What are they doing right? Are they eating healthy? Are they doing sleeping well? Are some people doing some things that are really positive, as well as what are the negative? Because nobody ever wants to hear only negative information. And so that's what really was the impetus to lead us on a quest, not only to focus on Alzheimer's, dementia, CTE, but what are some of the things? Where do we find victories? What community organizations are out there that are working on the grassroots level, rolling up their sleeves? What are they finding? What are they hearing? What are they doing? So that's really what we do at our conference. You know, we are sponsored by, fortunately, we receive funding from the National Institute of Aging. So we bring researchers together. We bring clinicians together. We also are funded by the Alzheimer's Association. They have a DEI initiative as well as their research arm to help support what we have is an emerging scholars program there. But then we also, and we feel that what's so important mm-hmm. is we bring community together. We bring community-based organizations. We work with Dr. Joanne Pugh. She is, or Ms. Joanne Pugh, I'm sorry. She is the author of The 50-Yard Line Mom. Her son played in the NFL, and she understands the issues that it goes through from being a parent and caring for a loved one. She's also part of the women's group for the NFL Wives. And so they're really important. We work with all kinds of organizations on the ground. So we take what's called a translational health perspective, as well as from a biobehavioral kind of perspective. And we feel as though it's important that each one of those groups, as well as the athletes themselves, you mentioned we have Hall of Famers that come, we have current athletes that come, we have former athletes that come, we have college athletes, we have all of them coming together talking about how can we advocate, how can we increase literacy, how can we get men involved with research projects, how can we disseminate information, and how can we get their families together. We think of it as a way, all of a community, that we need each other to actually help move the needle on improving the lives of everyone.
It really was such an impressive and powerful experience earlier this year when I was able to attend the conference here in Arizona. And one thing that I thought was so powerful is the discussion around the importance of encouraging these generational conversations. Could you elaborate on that for us?
Sure. And I just came back. I worked very closely with Guy Troop, who is the founder, CEO of the Players Networking event, he's going into his 23rd year. Guy has worked in the front office of the NFL. He's worked in the NCAA, and he's still every year he does the rookie symposiums for about 15, 16 teams after the draft every year to help the rookies get acclimated to what life means to be a professional athlete. So Guy has been around the sport a long, long time. He's seen a number of generations. You know, he's now working with guys who played back in the 80s, who are now the senior statesmen trying to help the younger people. And what out of that conversation, we talked about just the last couple of days, is, you know, the older guys feel it's their responsibility to help be advocates, put pressure on the NFL, put pressure on the NFL Alumni Association, speak to the NCAA, speak to high schools, right? Ron Rice, we just had this conversation the other day. He says, you know, he's a volunteer coach. And he says what he hears from parents all the time is when he says, my kid, when I try to talk to my kids about doing something, they don't pay any attention. But if that football coach tells the kid, hey, you got to do X, Y, Z at home, all of a sudden it was like it was the word of God. And so we recognize, lots of guys recognize their role that they have to play, not only in their own health, not only looking after their own health and making sure that they have the knowledge that's important for them to live a healthy life, but they also need to use the platform that they have, which is why so many guys have agreed to, we have this thing called a sports spotlight series that they'll speak on. They're working and willing to be ambassadors into the community, reaching out and using whatever celebrity that they might have. And, you know, let's face it, some of the older guys, people don't know them as much, or maybe their generation knew them, but we've been fortunate. It like Jonathan Ledbetter there in Arizona, who is currently playing. He's been willing to be very vulnerable about some of the challenges that he had even getting to the NFL, and then using his platform to speak to people who are in the league right now, people who are in college, and people who are in you know, the younger guys and their parents. So we recognize that it's really important. But the other thing that I think is really, really important as well, we need to learn from every level, every generation. As researchers, as clinicians, we need to hear the language that they use. We need to understand their voice. We need to understand their fears. And that helps us craft messaging. So I think probably the most valuable thing that I've learned by conducting this research is that, you know, you cannot live in an ivory tower. And it is not, it doesn't work if you say, hey, this is a research project that I've put together. I need you to participate in. My approach is, how do we work together to understand what's important to you, to your community? How do I take that message back to the funders, right? Sometimes it's incongruent. The funders want to know one thing, but the people in the community need to know another thing. How do we have everyone working together in the same accord, developing a language, developing approach, developing interventions that will lead to changes? And that's really what we've, you know, sports, we look at it as the front porch, just like college. It draws people in, but there's so much going on besides just sports at a university. There's so much that's more that's going on in our conference, but the athletes, their stories and what's important to them helps us as a real means of connecting with others.
I love the idea of sports being the front porch. And I am so grateful for your work with all of these hero athletes and how they are willing to use their platform and be vulnerable and to share their stories through their celebrity so that people really will listen, like you said. And this goal of understanding what the needs are and hearing the voices of the community, I think that's so critical. And one of the studies that you're doing that you talked about is about Black men who are caregivers. Will you share about your research about that study?
Sure. And I'm glad you asked. You. Thank you. It's the first study of its kind. It was funded as a pilot project by the National Institute of Aging. And what we wanted to do, we found another study that was done in Portland, Oregon. And that study was looking at kind of, I guess, the neurocognitive as well as the physiological impact of caregiving and stress, right? So Does it really stress your body as well as stress your mind? We needed to understand that. And reading that study, as typical in many other studies, about 75% of the individuals who were in that study were women. And I thought, well, does that mean that men are not caregivers? And then when we looked at the, you know, the demographic breakdown, the racial composition, you saw in that study, they did not report it. But then if you look at the demographics of Portland, you see that it is overwhelmingly a white community. So I started to think, well, what do we know? And how does caregiving impact physiologically and neurocognitively? How does that impact people of other populations? And given the work that I do with Black men, I wanted to understand that in the context here in Washington, D.C., in the DMV. So we did a pilot study. In that study, we've collected data from our comparison group, who are 40 men, 30 years and over, who do not provide care, informal care for a loved one. And for us, informal care means 10 hours a week of voluntary care for a loved one, 10 hours or more. And so we reached out into the community. And then the other group is we're comparing them to are the 40 men who do provide care for a loved one. And so what we do is we take a saliva sample so that way we can look at cortisol levels, which can relates to the level of stress. And then we do a whole health survey to try to understand your health behavior, health outcomes, and how that stress might function in your body. But then we also do a whole neurocognitive battery of examination, which is part of the UDS surveys. And so we look at everything from executive function to memory and those kinds of things. And then we also, we've done a focus group with some of those men, done some interviews, and we've been able to collect most of that data during COVID. And then once COVID was over, we invite them into the lab here at George Washington University so we can collect a little bit more data. We're at the tail end of that study now, but I would really like to encourage if anyone's out there listening and you have direct contacts with community organizations or people who live in the Washington, D.C., Maryland, or Virginia metro area, please have them reach out, take a look, contact us on my website, which is the rwturnerlab.com. We'd love to register them, get them involved. We only need 14 additional male caregivers involved. But one of the things that I really want to emphasize of what we learned just by being out in the community, going to health fairs, is we've had people tell us within this particular community, being culturally sensitive, particularly given some of the historic legacy around research and distrust and their interactions within the medical community, people have said to us, you know, don't use the word burden. Caregiving is not a burden to us. It is a responsibility. It's something that we love to do. Even though it's very difficult, it's a way that you honor individuals in your life that committed themselves to you. So we remove caregiver burden from the study. And then the other thing they said, don't use the word study, because people in our community, that's a very negative connotation. Again, with Tuskegee, Henrietta Lack out of in Baltimore. So we look at it as a project or a program, right? Allow us to conduct the research. So language matters. How you communicate, how you hear from people matter to the overall picture. Because I'm sure that your audience knows this, but of all the research that is conducted, Alzheimer's research, the Alzheimer's Association, their numbers indicate that only 5% of the participants who are in all of Alzheimer's research are Black. From the Black community, Black Americans, right? And of that, 75% of those participants are women, which means that Black men, they comprise of less than 2% of all Alzheimer's-related, dementia-related research. And so that's why it's imperative. That's why we started with that group, is because we really wanted to know. We know that the there are some organizations out there, AARP, they did a piece that said there are approximately 2 million Black men who are providing care for a loved one. Now, all of them are not providing care for someone with Alzheimer's or dementia, but they're providing care. So we know that there are a significant part of the population out there who care about their loved ones just like everybody else. We need to know, how does that impact their overall health? And I've been very fortunate that the Alzheimer's Association is partnering with me and helping me, you know, spread the word for that research, but then it's also funded by the National Institute of Aging.
You made a really powerful statement that it's imperative that Black men get involved in research to have their voices heard.
You have also created the Men's Brain Health Directory. Can you talk to us a little more about that and why it's so important to get involved?
Absolutely. We felt by working with all of these partners, these great scientists around the country that have really lent their names, they are lending their names as well as so many organizations. We felt like, you know, one of the things, how do we address the issues around distrust and all these other things? And one of the biggest issues about why Black men in particular, or maybe people from the Black community don't get involved with research is oftentimes because we just don't ask them. And so the registry or the directory gives an opportunity to ask people to get involved. But we recognize that some people are not quite ready yet. Some people will say, hey, wait a minute. I know it's important, but I don't know you, or I don't understand how research works. Many people don't understand what the difference between clinical trials and maybe some other types of descriptive types of research that might be done, qualitative, quantitative, all these things. There's a large amount of education that needs to be done. So what we wanted to do is we've started off by just saying, hey, listen, here's an opportunity for you to just join the registry or the directory, I'm sorry. And if you all you want to do is be a passive, you know, person, participant, where you want to hear from us, develop a relationship from us, you want to increase your health education, health literacy, we can do that. We disseminate lots of information to people. And it's open to all men, not just Black men, but it's open to all men, right? But then we also say those men who say, hey, listen, I get it. I understand your message resonates with me. I had a mom, a dad, or someone else that has Alzheimer's. I want to join. So the other part of the directory is you can fill out your whole profile, whether you've played sports, haven't played sports, want to learn about CTE or anything else like that, and what types of research projects you want to get involved. Do you want to do more about vascular, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, or any of those opportunities? And so when you fill out that information, then we have many different principal investigators who are running studies can contact us, and then they would be vetted through our directory. And if it has IRB approved and we feel as though it is culturally sensitive and they understand how to work with this population, then we only at that point where those people who have agreed to be contacted by other researchers, then we allow them to contact them directly and invite them to get into that study. So we're really trying to, again, use the health disparities research framework to make sure that we are culturally sensitive, we understand the individuals, we're using the language, and we're making sure that when people get involved, that they can trust the process of the individuals that we've placed into this, so that when they do contact someone, that they're speaking to them in a way that's respectful of their own personal culture and background.
This has been such an informative and energetic conversation. Before we close our discussion today, could you give us your final thought when it comes to Black men's brain health?
Sure. What we've learned, again, over and over and over again, when I do lots of focus groups, I do lots of interviews, we do a lot of data collection, we hear people's voices and what men say. And I think this is really, really important. Men say, in our groups at least, one of the reasons that they don't, well, a couple of reasons that they don't go to the doctors very much. And these are things that we need to think about in our research. But they say, hey, listen, when I go to the doctor, all I get is bad news. And then others have said, when I go to the doctors, it's expensive. And then you put that together. Some people say, why am I going to pay all this money to get bad news from something? I might as well just wait until I can't deal with it any longer. And that's when they go. Well, that doesn't help, especially when we're trying to spread the word of why it's so important to get early diagnosis when it comes to memory and your brain health, right? Cognitive issues, right? So we've got to change that narrative, right? We've also heard from the community that they want to work with people who look like them, people who understand where they come from. They're looking for Black doctors. They're looking for Black researchers. They're looking for other people who are sensitive to their needs. And so that's why we build into my research with the Black Men's Brain Health Conference. I just want to quickly mention, but we have a whole emerging scholars program where, again, we bring people from all different backgrounds together, all different disciplines, and say they want to learn how to conduct this research. We also bring them together with the clinicians and the researchers, because we need to build a workforce of people from no matter what backgrounds they are, Latino, Hispanic, they're, you know, from the Asian, Pacific Islanders, all those backgrounds. We're such a diverse country. We need a diversity of individuals who can work in these areas. And that's my other message, is we're trying to train people, come join us, get involved with what we do, join our Emerging Scholars Program, so that way you can take your unique perspectives back to the communities that you live in and come from, and you can touch them. Just like I'm focusing on Black men, you want to touch people from your own community as well.
And if our listeners want to get in touch with you to learn more about your book, the conference, the registry, the scholars program, what is the best way for them to find out more?
Well, the best way you can find out specifically is at rwturnerlab.com. That's our lab site at George Washington University. I say rwturnerlab.com. But then you can also learn about the conference, the Emerging Scholars Program, the directory, by going to mensbrainhealth.org. Again, mensbrainhealth.org. You can reach out to me personally there. There's my contact information. If you know of anyone or be willing to spread the news about our caregiver study, we would really love that. We have all kinds of materials available. And I'm also available if people want me to speak in their communities. I'm happy to do that as well. And I just want to say thank you for this opportunity to share a little bit about what we're doing and why we're excited about, you know, the impact that it can have.
Today, our conversation has been with Dr. Robert W. Turner II, an assistant professor at George Washington University School of Medicine and Health Sciences in the Department of Clinical Research and Leadership. We are so grateful for your time, your energy, and your passion as you helped us untangle men's brain health.
Thanks a bunch. And I look forward to seeing you all in Vegas.
Thank you so much, Dr. Turner. And I also just want to thank your volunteers and those who research with you and all of the amazing athletes who are using their platform to shine a light on this important topic. Thanks to everyone. And I want to thank you, Heather, for another great conversation, and this one about protective factors and risk factors and resilience. And thanks to you, our listeners, for joining us. If you haven't already, please subscribe and share this podcast. I'm looking forward to our next conversation on Dementia Untangled. Thank you for joining us for this episode of Dementia Untangled. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Dementia Untangled is hosted by Heather Mulder and Janice Greeno, produced and edited by Amber Ayers, and is brought to you by Banner Alzheimer's Institute and Banner Sun Health Research Institute. We are supported by generous donations to the Banner Alzheimer's Foundation.
Please visit our website at bannerhealth.com/Alzheimer's and follow us on Facebook to learn about upcoming events. If you have questions or comments, please email us at dementiauntangled@bannerhealth.com.